insert snappy smart aleck intro, and then you would be able to say, this is the Pop Culture Uncovered podcast. This is the end of the year show.
Man, that's efficient.
So of course, as always, first there's Pete. Pete, how goes it?
Not bad. Look, we've only got a few weeks to the end of the year, and I just want everything to be fine.
And of course, we got Belle with us. Belle, how goes it?
It goes.
Well, that's
and
what
that's
happens.
All I have to say about that.
So, we're almost at 2024, but we do still have geeky stuff to talk about. So, for the holidays, we thought it would be fun if we brought to you our top three favorite things in pop culture we liked this year, in no particular order, with the exception of Belle, because I can tell you the first thing she's going to talk about probably is her actual number one. So, Belle, we'll start with you. Give us, you know, tell me at least your first favorite thing this year.
My first thing with favorite thing is Loki, which you already knew. Since we have already done a couple of deep dives, I know you're shocked and amazed, whatever. Anyway, since we've already done a couple of deep dives on this, I'm not going to go into it too much. All I'm going to say is that this was one of the better things I've seen, not just from Marvel since the end of Endgame, which everybody has said across the board pretty much, but I want to say in pop culture and in television and film, maybe in probably the last 5 years, the emotional impact of that show was so good. And while it did set up a great, both season one and two set up a plethora of things in the MCU, it managed to do the one thing that nothing in the MCU has been able to do for quite some time, which is be a completely self-contained story that was completely satisfying in and of itself. And not, you could go into it not having seen anything previously and be okay. And that is quite a feat with, at this point, going on 15 years of backstory. So many things in MCU are dependent on knowing what happened before. And with this show, they basically got that out of the way in episodes one and two of the first season, and then they moved on. And so it's one of the most remarkably well-written, well-acted, well-produced. The production values alone are worth coming to the table because, and I will continue to harp on this, they built the sets. This was one of the few things the MCU has done that used only about 10% of CGI. And the difference is startling to the point that because Loki looks so much better than everything else that came out in terms of Disney in recent years, especially the TV series, that now the other shows are actually building sets and not relying so heavily on CGI. It changed, and they had to fight tooth, the production crew had to fight tooth and nail, apparently, to be able to build physical sets. And I cannot emphasize enough how much of a difference it makes that they had actual physical things. When you see the season finale of season two, series finale, apparently, of season two, there's a moment where Loki is physically holding something, and he is physically holding something. And that's why it looks so good. I'm not going to spoil it for those who haven't seen it, but it looks damn good. And the fact that the acting matches is just icing on the cake. It also did something that has been extremely rare for the MCU across the board, which is introduce new characters who don't seem superfluous, who have a huge impact on not just the characters in the show, but the wider MCU. And that seems to be something that a lot of the new characters that have been introduced in the last few years have been forgettable. And this is a time where that has not been the case. I love every single one of these characters, even Sylvie, who I wanted to hit a couple of times. I love her and I want the best for her. And that's rare. So as I want to say, Forbes said, the MCU and every other franchise needs to do more like Loki. Ground it in your characters. And it's amazing when you have the characters write the plot, so the plot writing the characters, the difference it makes.
No, I mean, the only reason why Loki is not going to make one of my top three is because I knew you were going to mention it. So there was no point in beating a dead horse. But no, I have to agree with you. I mean, I thought Loki was without a doubt the best thing that the MCU produced this year. No disrespect to the Marvels, because I haven't seen it yet. So I can't say whether I thought it was good or bad. I literally haven't seen it. But this was the thing I loved the most since Werewolf by Night. By Night. By leaps and bounds. And I think, Bell, to your credit, you have for years kind of advocated for people need to appreciate Tom Hiddleston's performances because of how amazing he is as an actor. And I can say, as somebody who vehemently did not like Loki as a character, not whether in print or on screen, I just accepted him as a necessary evil to bring the Avengers together, since canonically that's what happens. Tom Hiddleston was successful in convincing me to despise this character. And I walked out at the end of season two saying, that's one of the best character performances and arcs that I've ever seen before. Again, not trying to spoil it for anybody. If you are interested in a deep dive on it, please do check out our earlier episode. Pete, did you have anything you wanted to add on Loki?
It was way better. The first season was a lot of fun and opened up a lot of possibilities. And the second season really just lived up to the hype. And it had been long enough since the first season of Loki that you almost forgot how good this show already was. And then they dropped this bomb. And in a lot of ways that I think they were unafraid to do things that, you know, honestly, it feels like in a lot of Marvel movies, they've been holding back. And in this show, they didn't.
No, well said. All right, Bell, you've got to break down your second pick for me, because you know, as I always talk about, I have small children. I never seem to be able to have time to watch everything, but I keep hearing talk of the House of Usher being fantastic and being something that I should check out and watch to see and make time for as appointment TV. So for people like me who are drowning in small people and small people's laundry, can you explain to me why I should have checked out The House of Usher by now?
Woo, child, we ain't got time for that. I will try to do this as quickly as possible. Well, first of all, for those who are not familiar, Fall of the House of Usher is based on all of Edgar Allan Poe's short stories. So the framing is the original book, The House of Usher. And for those of you who don't know, in this story, Madeline and Frederick Usher are twins in the original story, whose someone in the family line made a deal with something that they should not have a long time ago. And the deal came due in the original story. And so they are the end of the family line. That's the framing device of the series. Now, in Fall of the House of Usher on Netflix, each of the main characters are named after and their storylines are taken from very specific Poe stories, like the Rue Morgue or the Casket of Amontillado or the Black Cat. And so the framing is the Usher children are named after the characters from the original short stories, and each of their downfalls is tied to one of those stories. Okay? That's all I'm going to say, because other than that, anything else would be honestly too spoilery. I will say it was filmed in Baltimore. Mike Flanagan is from Baltimore. If you watch his shows, every single one of his shows is filmed here. Well, The Haunting of Hill House, Midnight Mass, those shows are filmed here in Baltimore. So the gorgeous cathedral that's on Cathedral Street, aptly named, that was where a lot of the action takes place in the show. And he used a lot of local actors and actresses for the show as well. So that being the case, beyond the fact that it's a Baltimore production from somebody who always remembers his roots, Mike Flanagan and his good people. So, and it's always nice to support somebody who actually puts their money where their mouth is. So that's always nice. But beyond that, this was one of the most terrifying shows I have ever watched. When I tell you guys that I had to stop after an episode and not watch the next episode, I needed at least a couple of days in between each episode because it genuinely stayed with me. And one of the things that my mom pointed out, because she and I watched it together, she was like, for this to be one of the scariest things I've ever watched, it's gorgeous to look at, which is rare in horror. That is genuinely something that is rare in horror, where not only is it scary, but it's beautiful. I mean, when I tell you the deaths were gorgeous, there's no other way to put it. Just beautifully framed, beautifully, you knew what was coming. You wanted the people not to, to die, but, well, some of them you wanted to die, but some of them you didn't want to die, but every death was filmed and framed so beautifully. The acting, I know I'm going to mess up this young man's name, Raul Cahill, who, for those of you who watched iZombie, he was the co-lead on that. He is magnificent in this show. He is the heart of the family. And his character, he's not necessarily a good person, but he loves his family. And his devastation as the events unfold makes you give a shit. He's okay. Not a good person. He's a video game developer, and he's, you know, he's a poor little rich boy. But he genuinely loves his family. He genuinely wants to be a better person, but he doesn't have the tools. And I think that that was one of the things that the show did a really good job of, which is trauma inflicts more trauma. And until you deal with what the trauma is, until you acknowledge it, all you're going to do is pass that trauma on to the next generation. Frederick and Madeline were severely traumatized, not only by their upbringing, but by what happens to their mother in the first episode and the fallout from that. And then they proceed unwittingly to just pass on that same trauma to the kids. And none of these kids have coping mechanisms, because Frederick never dealt with his trauma, and his way of dealing with it is to just throw more money at his kids instead of getting them the help that they need and for dealing with his own issues. And so while the show is terrifying, it is, oh my God, the Rue Morgue episode alone, woo, the nightmares I had, y'all, the nightmares. I literally had nightmares behind the episode. But that's not the important thing. And that's one of the threads that runs through everything that Mike Flanagan does, which is you have to deal with your issues. If you don't, you're going to just pass them on to the next generation, and it's nothing good is going to come of it, and it's just going to keep building. But beyond all of that, Mark the Man Hamill, y'all, for those of you who don't know Mark Hamill as the Joker, people who didn't know what Mark Hamill was capable of and weren't prepared, honey, Mark Hamill better get every nomination on this earth for his performance on this show. I am not even, he is utterly terrifying on this show, because he's the family fixer. He's the one, oh, you killed the hooker? Got it. I dealt with that. I'll deal with that. Oh, you accidentally murdered somebody? I got this. Oh, you want to find blackmail on your enemies? Bet. And the menace in every step, in every movement, in every way he moves. But the weird thing is, and again, this goes to Mike Flanagan's direction and Mark Hamill as an actor and the writing of the show, you can tell he cares about the family. He loves those kids. So it's all in service to protecting these kids. even from themselves. And so he is, the minute he comes on scene, you're like, all right, you know what? Whatever it is, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to do it. I am so sorry. I am so sorry. Whatever it is, I am sorry. Please don't come any closer because I am skirt. He is so good on this show. Between this and What We Do in the Shadows, Mark Hamill, he better get all of his nominations. That's all I have to say. He's so damn good. This show was phenomenal. I would not watch it with kids. Okay. I wouldn't watch this with anybody under the age of 18, to be honest.
Okay, all right.
It's that terrifying.
Okay, so this is definitely them not making the family list. Pete, go ahead. Not
even a little bit.
So I got a question, Belle, because I feel like we've seen this approach a couple times, most notably, I think, with Castle Rock, which is sort of an amalgamation of a lot of different Stephen King stories in that way that Stephen King has sort of already linked everything together. I mean, to be honest, every single work of Edgar Allan Poe's that I've read felt like it existed in the same universe before that was even a thing that we thought about. And so I guess my question is how successful is that not only bringing things more modern, but taking bits and pieces from other stuff? Because it can feel almost like it's selling the works short to do it that way. And I feel like there was mixed success with Castle Rock, but this is one of the ones that I'm curious to see how it works with Edgar Allan Poe's works.
I think it's very organic because the framing device of the siblings, Madeline and Roderick, I think because they frame it as a corporation. So the siblings found this corporation and it becomes basically the Amazon. It's like if you combine Amazon and what the Statler family has done with the drug industry, and it's this monster. So now their fingers are in everything, whether it's entertainment, drugs, fashion, their fingers are in everything. So by having that framing device, and each of the kids have a specific thing that they are. So one daughter is in charge of the PR arm, and one daughter is a brilliant scientist, so she's in charge of the medical arm. One daughter is the front face for the fashion industry. She's basically Goop. She's basically the Gwyneth Paltrow. She's the front face report. The one son, like I said, is a video game designer. The other one runs clubs. They're in all of these pies. So because of that framing device of this megacorp, and as we all know, those places don't exactly run, especially when they're family run, don't exactly play by the same rules. That framing device actually allows the stories to breathe more in a way than I think Castle Rock had the room to breathe. Castle mm-hmm. Rock, in my opinion, tried to stick too much to trying to make it modern and put it in this box, whereas because they have this big open platform to play with, it allowed the stories to breathe in a way that I don't actually think an adaptation would be allowed to do these days.
Okay,
so did a really good job of using that framing device to give the story way more room to breathe.
Okay, so if somebody wants to watch The House of Usher, what is it on?
It's on Netflix.
Okay.
You could also buy, I believe Netflix said that they're going to allow people to buy the full series.
Okay. How many seasons?
Which is rare for them.
Just one season or?
It's just one season. It's a fully contained story. And this, for those who don't know, this will be Mike Flanagan's last project with Netflix.
Okay.
And it is a masterpiece. If this is what you're going to go out, if this is how you're going to go out, then this is the way to do it. Because it is an absolute masterpiece. He has said that he feels like this is time for him to move on from this collaboration. And I just wish him nothing but the best of luck in the next thing he does. And if anything he does comes to a tenth of the level of this show, then the man is golden from here on out. Because this show was just... Whew.
Okay, yeah. That's high praise coming from you. All right, so that's The House of Usher. Now... ironically, the last of your favorite things for this year is actually a series that got canceled. A little bit unexpected.
And then renewed. it was very up and down.
It's just like if it was magic. So yeah, so Willow. Of course, the Disney Plus series that was based off the classic 1980s fantasy film starring Val Kilmer.
Val Kilmer and Warwick Davis and Joan Whaley.
Thank you. So one, Belle, I didn't know that Willow got uncanceled. So
yeah.
So can you touch
right? On, I was so, all sad. So now, I don't know how to feel.
It was bonkers. It was like that was like 3 weeks of absolute bonkersness. So yeah, apparently it was put on hiatus, and then maybe they canceled it, and then they didn't cancel it, and then they did cancel it, and then they brought it back. And I was like, pick a struggle. But at any rate, there will be apparently 3 full seasons, as was set up on the show, because the end of season one was book one, and they showed that the season one was the first book. So they only had 3 books, so they want to do all 3 seasons. And I believe that part of the reason why it was uncanceled is because, to be perfectly frank, we don't know how long we're going to have Warwick Davis. So if you're going to do it, you got to do it now, because between Warwick and Val, we don't know how long we're going to be able to keep both of them. Willow, for me, was one of the most delightful little surprises of the past year. It was going to go on my list last year for the end of the year, but it came in right under the line for best of. It came in because it started at the end of the year and came into 2023. That show was just, remember how much we all hated The Last Jedi?
Oh, geez, Belle. I can barely remember having strong feelings about that film.
Because of one of the
reasons. We never talk about it at all.
Not at all. And one of the main reasons that we hated The Last Jedi was how they handled Luke. Willow is the blueprint for how Luke Skywalker should have been handled. Is he absolutely a grumpy ass old man at this point? Yep. Is he tired of your shit? Yes. Does he not want to be here training these new children to do what he did? Yep. Is he here to do the job anyway? Yep. Does he give a shit? Does he love them with all of his heart and will do whatever is necessary to keep them alive? Yep. Is he going to tell you to your face that you're a fuck up? Yep. Willow was... Warwick Davis does not get credit for the amazing actor he is. He truly does not. You don't have a career for as long as you have, as he has had one, just because you're a niche. I don't care how niche you are. There are other people who have dwarfism, who have not had the careers, who were actors, who have not had the careers Warwick Davis has had. Warwick Davis, the levels that man commands on this show. There's a sequence on the show that is so upsetting, where Willow sees his daughter in a vision as she has been taken over, because they were finally able to release. Remember how in the movie they were trying to release these demons,
mm-hmm.
and they weren't able to actually do it because mm-hmm. of Willow, and he has a vision of. Actually, yeah, they were able to do it. And the scene with the young lady who's his actual daughter in real life, the scene where he sees what will happen, the prophetic vision he has, is so utterly terrifying, but also heartbreaking. And that is Warwick Davis's performance. Then you get into the other cast. Everybody came back for this, including Val. Val was only in voice because he was so ill at the time, but he wanted to be a part of this show. So he does the voice work for it and records new voice work for it. And his son physically plays him in the show. When we do see Matt Mardigan, it's his son, his and Joanne Wiley's actual child playing him, who looks just like him, by the way. But Willow for me was exactly what I want out of high fantasy. It was absolutely so much fun. It was sincere. And I think that that is something that is missing in a lot of shows right now, particularly fantasy and science fiction, is genuine sincerity. It's like we treat that as it's cheesy. Wearing your heart on your sleeve is cheesy, and Willow wore its heart on its sleeve the entire time. The cameos on the show are great. I'm not going to spoil. There's a couple of folks who show up that are fantastic. And one of the things I really like is that they don't feel like they are shoved in, which is really hard, She-Hulk, to do without it feeling like it's the cameo is for cameo's sake. These characters are here and they're very well written characters, and they just happen to be played by these people who are wildly famous. It just, the ending broke my heart. The ending made me, let's talk about Tony Revolori. Let's talk about what an amazing actor Tony Revolori is, aka Flash Thompson from the new Spider-Man series. He is, if Warwick Davis is the heart of Willow, Tony Revolori's character, Prince Graydon, is the soul. And from episode one, you fall in love with him. From episode one, when he's like, oh, are we fighting? I don't fight. He's like, I don't do that. I can talk my way out of anything, but if you want me to start fighting, I am not the man for this, and I do not want to participate. I would very much like to not be included in the fighting part. And he's so sweet, and he's so kind. He's so unfailingly kind, which then you find out he's got a demon locked inside of him. And it's like, oh, goodness. Oh, this poor boy. And that's not even a huge spoiler. That's not even, like, when I tell you that's not even a spoiler, it's just horrible and it's just a fact. He is so good in this part. And I just really enjoy him. I have enjoyed him in everything I've seen him in. And I really hope that he gets the career he deserves. Everyone in the cast is phenomenal. But Tony Revolori, I really hope that he blows up even bigger than he has, because he, in this part, really shows his range in a way that he has not really been allowed to in the Spider-Man movies. And the other films that he has done with, because he's a part of Wes Anderson's crew, and he's great in those, but he hasn't really been allowed to be to have the level of range that he has had on this show. I really hope that we get season two sooner rather than later, now that the strike is over. And I really hope that they continue to do right by these characters. Mm-hmm. I also really like the fact that there's so much LGBTQIA representation on the show. And again, it doesn't feel ham-fisted. It doesn't feel forced. It's just there.
All right, that's what's up. Well, I mean, that there go Bell's top three picks for stuff for this year. So definitely, I would definitely tell you to check out the House of Loki, because at least I've seen all of that one. I personally haven't watched Willow, but it's on my Christmas list. House of Usher sounds rather depressing. I'll have to wait till like election season. That sounds like a good time, because why? I mean, when everything's falling apart in real life, it's always entertaining to watch it fall apart on TV too. Well, that's Bell's picks for the end of the year. Thanks for spending some time with us. Can't wait to catch you in the new year. But while you might miss us over the holiday break, I do have good news. There's a part two and a part three to this. So next episode, we'll get a chance to hear from, we'll hear Pete's picks about what he liked most this year. I can absolutely guarantee you, I probably will agree on absolutely none of them, because it's Pete. And when do Pete and I ever functionally agree about anything?
I don't know, once or twice a decade, you know.
I mean, you do have a Tribe Called Quest t-shirt on, so all right, so fine. So So Pete gets 1.5 cool points. We'll see how many cool points he gets officially awarded on the next episode. As always, check us out on Patreon. Support us on Patreon. Like, listen, and subscribe. Be well. Take care. And I'll talk to you soon. Peace.